Blog Talk Radio.
Your show will go live in 5 seconds. Oops. Four.
What did I do?
I'm not sure.
You there, Amy? All right. Welcome, everybody.
Your show will go live in 5 seconds. Oops. Four.
I muted that. Are you say something, Amy?
Yeah, I'm here, but okay. Why does it keep repeating that?
I think because I'm not muted and YouTube is not muted, so YouTube is feeding it back to us. Okay, but YouTube is
see,
not
okay.
Okay,
thank you.
I killed it. Hi, everybody, hello. And welcome to the first episode of the Oran Brook and Amy Peacock show. None of the above, although we're going to be debating the title.
We're
so we'll
good,
see.
Yes.
We'll see if we stick to that title. Welcome. We're streaming this on YouTube and on Facebook. I'm trying to get it to stream on Periscope, but it looks like Periscope is resisting. So I'll have to putz around with Periscope another time. But hi, Amy.
Can I just say how glad I am that you're handling all this technology, by the way?
Well, you know me. I'm just I just like to jump in and get all this done. So Amy's in 4 hours behind me. Amy's in I'm actually not recording this. I was supposed to record it. Let me record it. Recording.
Please. Now. Please
into
do
the
record.
Cloud. All right. So Amy's all the way in California and I am on the other side of what is still the United States, Puerto Rico. So,
thanks, the name. Technology. We
you
can
want to
do
say
this.
Something about the name? Why are we
yeah.
calling ourselves?
Okay.
None
so,
of the above?
So I was announcing our little show on Facebook, and then Luca, a listener to your show and
yeah,
my show,
yeah.
he says, "Oh, you're going to have some Duran Duran intro music, no doubt," because he knows me. I love Duran Duran.
I have
said,
to
oh.
say this. I thought I managed to skip over the whole 80s music thing. I really tried, you know, the 80s. I was into classical music, and I thought I and now you're going to drag me into 80s music.
So you're a decadist, essentially, is what you're saying. You're a decadist.
I'm a decadist. I can do 60s and 70s music, and I can do 19th century music, but the 80s just – you know, it hasn't really connected with me.
So for me, right, you know, this, of course, was just right around the time MTV started and I was this young teenager. And Duran Duran had this sense of life that just kind of carried me through. Also, I moved a lot. So when I got to a new place, yep. I could instantly have friends because they were the Duran Duran fans. So it was this whole thing for me.
Oh, wow.
In any event, let me tell you why.
None of I was lonely and didn't have any friends.
You were lonely and didn't have any friends?
Because we moved a lot. We moved around a lot in the 70s. So, you know, so I listened to sad, lonely music in the 70s. There was a lot of good stuff.
Okay. Sad, lonely. But you're so optimistic. How can you listen to sad, lonely music?
I love sad, lonely music. I mean, I think it's really pretty.
Okay.
All right.
So none of the above came to mind. And in the song, the lyrics are, you know, not that involved, but he has this lyric, money, power, holy roads, freedom puts my faith in none of the above. And I see it sort of as an atheistic song. But for us, if we were going to call the show None of the Above, there's a couple things to think about. One, of course, is that we are none of the above in the sense that we're not leftist, we're not conservative, and we're not even really libertarian.
Yep.
So that people are going to hear stuff here that they haven't heard anyplace else. So there's that sense. But another sense kind of plays off the atheist theme in the song, because Simon Le Bon is this out in the world atheist. He's done little parts of books on atheism and stuff like that. But for us, it's not just atheism. It's none of the above in the sense that we don't put anything above the individual. And that's the sense in which I think of it. So obviously Le Bon would not be happy because he's somewhat of a leftist, liberal, and he would, in a sense, put a collective above the individual, probably. Although it'd be fun to debate him about it and say, you know, why do you shirk off God? But yeah, none of the above. So no religion, no collective, no nationalism, nothing above the individual.
So my only concern is that it's negative, right? It doesn't say what we're for. It says, well, we're not, right? We're not this, we're not that, we don't put anybody above, above what? There's no implication about what it is that we're for. So, I don't know. None of the above, it sounds too negative.
Okay.
That's my concern. So, I'm opening it up to a vote out there on in YouTube and Facebook land and Blog Talk land. We got a number of people on Blog Talk. Usually nobody listens on Blog Talk. So I'm curious about what you guys think. Go ahead and say yes or no, and then we'll count them up afterwards and see who wins. I'm not saying that we'll go by majority, but your input would help, right?
None of the Above is an awesome title. It's awesome. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, if you like Amy more than you like me, then vote for that.
Totally subjective.
It's not like
forget objectivism out the window.
Not really fair. So.
No, it's a really good point. The idea that we should define ourselves positively and not negatively. And in fact, when I was talking about Jordan Peterson's book, my main criticism is that he starts out with suffering is bad, and so the good is anything that counters suffering, and you don't want to define by a negative, right? So I understand.
Yeah, although, you know, there's an interesting issue there in a sense that there's a sense in which, you know, he's onto something without knowing it, because it is the possibility of death that gives value, meaning, right? And that's the whole immortal robot that Ayn Rand talks about.
Mm-hmm.
And suffering.
He's got a great example like that too, by the way.
Yeah.
He does Superman.
Oh, good. Well, in a sense, the suffering is a stand-in for death. So if you think about it that way, it's not a bad thing.
Right,
but him, it plays a much bigger role, and therefore it's.
I mean, but the way I would look at it is, okay, well, once you've made the decision to live, then you focus on the things that are required to live, on the provision of the values, the things you can enjoy here.
Yep.
And he's got so much of the focus on the suffering, and it pervades the entire book. The book, by the way, is, you know, and now you kind of know the punchline, but it reads sort of like a mystery, because in the beginning, in the Deutsch introduction, he tells you how this man has on the walls of his home these posters of Soviet propaganda, and you think, why would anybody do this? Yeah, we want to fight tyranny, but why would you surround yourself with reminders of this horrible, you know,
because that's what we're all, that's what's possible to all of us,
To him, exactly, and that's what actually we're going to talk about in terms of news. So,
all right.
You know, again, people are going to decide whether they like None of the Above as a title, but what I had in mind today was, as we go through different stories, we would highlight where it is, of course, that we're providing something that's unique and not like everybody else's answer.
Yeah.
And the first story I did want to revisit, I know it's an unpleasant topic, but the shooter, the scumbag from this week who decided he needed to kill 17 people.
Amy, you got to be less judgmental.
I never used their name. I shouldn't have used, I think I said his name. I usually just try to call them scumbag.
Yeah, scumbag is good.
Scumbags work. Yep. So you had, you know, and the one way in which you're different is when the people on the left do call for some sort of gun control measures, you don't necessarily just completely dismiss that out of hand. You say, okay, if we could find something that would be effective, maybe you'd be open to it, right?
Yeah, we're going to lose half of viewership now. You know, because people.
Let me come in right away and say that the latest headline shows that probably all the stuff that we had on the books are the things that should have been effective, and that we weren't doing the things that were possible given everything we already have on the books.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like the FBI blew it, but of course, the FBI probably blows it every day in the sense that they probably get lots of, you know, people coming to them. This guy's crazy. This guy's this. This guy's threatening this. And they probably can't investigate everything. And, you know, they really blew it. If we go back to 9/11, you remember they had all the elements to connect together to lead them to stop 9/11 in advance. They had the flight schools. They had these Muslims. You know, they stopped one of them for speeding. They actually caught one of them, the hijacker that never made it to the plane. And they blew it. And the FBI is going to blow it periodically. I don't think we can... I don't know that we can conclude anything dramatic from the fact that the police are not always 100% right about stuff. The question is, are the laws on the book with regard to guns today right? Are they too restrictive? Are they too lenient? And I think my answer mostly is I don't know. But I'm not one of these people who, and I've talked about this. There's a video of me doing why objectivism is hard to apply, where I talk about gun rights. I mean, I don't think it's that straightforward to say, oh, you should be able to arm yourself. And Ayn Rand said many times, look, this is a complex legal issue. It's for legal philosophy to figure this out. She didn't have a clear position on it. Obviously, I think you should be able to be armed to defend yourself. But I also think that because weapons are means of violence and the government has a monopoly over the use of retaliatory force, they should have some ability to monitor the tools of violence. Guns are meant to kill people. Drop the, you know, people should drop the BS of hunting and so on. Nobody's going to stop people from hunting and everything. But guns that we're talking about are meant for killing people. And the government has an interest in that. That's the one thing the government is supposed to do. So I think the government has a role in monitoring it, exactly what that role is, how it should execute it. What are all the different things that should be done? My answer is I just don't know. And I don't think anybody out there is really – I haven't seen a really clear analysis of what should and shouldn't be included under a – I would rewrite the Second Amendment. I mean, it really needs to be, you know, because we don't have militia and, you know, we're not really going to overthrow the U.S. government. That's not the purpose of accumulating guns. I've talked about this before. If we want to overthrow the U.S. government, let's do it, right? But don't pretend that your AR-15
is going to help. Okay, so when I think about that rationale for it, I think of this. I think that if you and I, for instance, have an agreement, we make a contract, an enforceable contract, and it's not on the premise like, oh, I think you're going to cheat me or anything else. It's just a good normal thing. And so it doesn't mean, you know, if I want to have a gun and part of the reason that I want to have a gun is in case someday our government goes bad, that's not necessarily a bad rationale for everybody, at least having some sort of weapon that's capable of defending ourselves within legitimate spheres.
Yeah, but I think that's right. But you have to be realistic about it in the sense that they have nukes, they have tanks, right. They have F-16s and F-15s. And, you know, what is your AR-15 going to do? You can go out into the mountains. We can romanticize this about fighting the military of the United States. But really, I mean, it ain't happening. So what I've said before is if we're serious about a revolution, right, then let's start breaking into, you know, they're going to cut me off on Facebook here. Hey, let's break into military facilities. Let's steal tanks. Let's get
hypothetical.
Let's get those missiles on our side. Forget about the AR-15s. Let's get some real weapons. And let's not appeal to the Second Amendment. Let's just appeal to the fact that we're starting a revolution and we're overthrowing the government. So my point is that the main reason to own a gun is self-defense. And the main moral legitimacy from which I think you derive the laws for holding, for having a gun, maintaining a gun, owning a gun, the question of concealed weapon permit, all of that is the issue of self-defense. That is where that right to own a gun comes from. It's the right to defend oneself in an emergency because you can't go chasing after the guys, right? Now, that's the job of the police. So somebody has to do real philosophical work about that, and it's not me. All I'm saying is the gut response to the left of, oh, no, don't take my – keep your hands off of my guns and we should have more guns, not fewer guns, and all this stuff. I don't necessarily buy. People say if the teachers had gun in the schools, then these things wouldn't happen. True, if the teachers were trained to use those guns.
Right.
So they would have to be really trained. They would have to want to have the guns. So I agree that and then what happens when one of the teachers goes rogue and shoots up a bunch of his fellow teachers or maybe students? I just think – there are no simple solutions to these kinds of things. And I think it's superficial of the right to jump on this. I also think we have to consider that violence is down. Deaths generally from violence are down. This is Steven Pinker's work is pretty conclusive about this. Mm-hmm. And while this is horrible what happened in the school and these school shootings are really – I mean,
they're the worst of nihilism, really.
Yeah.
They really are.
We can't overblow them in the sense that, I think I think is it, what is really, really problematic here is that this is a reflection of nihilism. Mm-hmm. That's what's scary about it more than anything else.
Well, and that's the other thing that I think viewpoint of this show provides that's unique is a perspective on what is required to counter that nihilism, because Jordan Peterson in his book, of course, is trying to counter that nihilism as well. But ironically, I actually think that the thing that he's countering it with in part helps to make the type of nihilism that he's talking about possible. And it explains why the posters are on the wall. But going back to what you talked about the other day, you talked about the need to bring back enlightenment values and reliance on reason in the culture. Everything that the kids are being, you know, instructed in schools and everything, all the propaganda that they're receiving is telling them, don't trust your means of survival. And,
absolutely.
You know, if you tell somebody, don't trust your means of survival, but go out and feel great about yourself and your prospects for life and success and everything else, there's no way. And then this kid lost his mom in November or something, but, you know, you don't know.
It's not just the nihilism goes up. It's schizophrenia goes up. And Leonard Peikoff has spoken a lot about this. It's depression. I mean, people are surprised that depression is on the rise. I mentioned this in a previous show that kids who are using iPhones tend to be depressed. And I wonder, you know, maybe kids that are depressed are using iPhones. I mean, the causality. But kids are depressed. The depression is up. All the surveys show that. But yeah, if you teach people that their mind is not their means of survival. It's not their basic means of survival. They shouldn't trust it. They should rely on emotions. Well, they're going to screw up. They're going to fail. They're going to be miserable. They're going to be depressed. They're going to be psychotic. I mean, some of them will actually get psychologically completely messed up. And some of them will become nihilists. And some of them will become nihilists, but too cowardly in a sense. Cowardly is the wrong word. But too passive to actually act on it. And a tiny, small minority will become nihilistic enough to actually act on it. Although one of the real dangers of the movement towards authoritarianism is the outlet for that nihilism long-term is to join a gang with power, you know, a Hitler Youth, an Antifa, the neo-Nazi, something like that. And then you have an outlet and a group which makes you more, quote, courageous, because now you're acting together with other people. That's the real long-term dangers. As nihilism rises, more authoritarianism, more gangs, and so on.
A couple things from my reading of Peterson's book. One of them is that he talks about the fact that kids with violent impulses, actual kind of violent impulses that you could see from the beginning, very, very small minority, but they'll show up by about 2. And these kids will, you know, hit and bite and things with other kids. And Peterson talks about the problem with parents not being willing to discipline these kids in the way that is necessary, the importance of socializing kids. Now, you know, he says you have to socialize kids so that they can join the group and then you can become there is some importance in properly socializing the children. It's not so they can, quote, join a group. I think that isn't so helpful. But you know, he says you've got to do this before age 4. You have to be willing, if your kid is one of these really extreme problem cases, to even come in with the minimum necessary physical force to stop the kid from doing this. And he thinks that parents who just want to be friends to their children and, you know, are scared to use any force at all against a kid, even in appropriate situations, that's part of the cause. You know, that's a very controversial topic. You know, do you use any physical force against a kid? But if you say, you know, you've got one of these small minorities of either kids that are really violent or kids who want to go run out in the middle of the road and splat themselves in front of a car or something, right?
Well, I mean, we're going to lose another half of the listeners now.
You're going to lose, right?
No, I absolutely believe you use physical force against kids, not in the sense of hitting them, but in the sense of restraining them. I think the job of the parent partially is to, in a sense, replace reality. You don't want, because the kid doesn't have the cognitive tools to deal with reality, you have to replace it. So the kid could run into the street and get hit by the car. You don't want that to happen. So you have to, in a sense, restrain them, move them away from that threat and act as reality. And I, you know, I'm not against yelling at kids. I'm not against scaring them a little bit. They have to realize that there are threats out there, and it's better that that threat get manifest in a parent who's doing it out of a sense of a protection than reality actually doing it, right? That the car actually hits you, or that something really bad happens to you. So I'm not one of these that you need a, you should talk to the kids and always, because they don't have the tools to deal with what you're talking to them about. They don't have the cognitive ability. And if you deal with them above their cognitive ability, you know, you have to do it a little bit, but if you're way above, I think what you're teaching them is that, you know, it's a form of rationalism, a complete detachment from reality, because it's not part of their reality, the concepts that you're using. So you have to push them, but you can't be, you know, so far, you know, above them that they can't comprehend it, and they get a false sense of what using language and argument really is.
So you're saying being a parent is tough?
Being a parent is really tough. It's very, very difficult, and it's very, very difficult to calibrate it just right. And but to go back to Jordan Peterson's point, now I don't know. I mean, he knows the psychological studies much better than I do, and I don't trust psychological studies generally. Because I think Ayn Rand was right that the field is still in its infancy and it's not quite a science yet. So I'm a skeptic when it comes to psychology generally and to therapists, and I don't think most of them know what they're doing. But I think there's a great field there for rational inquiry, but I'm not sure we're there yet, and for real science. So I don't know if it's 2 or if it's 4 or if it's 15. But the point is that part of what these kids lack is objectivity. That is the willingness of a parent to say, this is wrong, this is right, this is evil, this is good, and manifest that in how they treat them. That is behind the punishment or not to punish, right? The punishment is an evaluation. It's saying what you're doing is wrong. When you don't punish, you're basically saying you can do whatever you feel like doing. Your emotions are completely okay. And yeah, we might restrain you, but we're not going to label it. We're not going to say it's good or bad. And part of what parenting is about is giving kids that sense of objectivity. And part of what teaching in a school should be about is teaching kids that there is such a thing as an objective reality. There are such things that lead to positive outcomes, and there are other things that lead to negative outcomes in history, and in your behavior in the playground, and in math, and in every one of these fields, there's actually an objective reality. And one side, certain behaviors lead to good, and certain behaviors lead to bad. And that's what they're not getting. And that's exactly your point about the cognition and reason are impotent, right? They're not taught that they're evaluative functions.
And that's where I think Peterson's book fails in a certain way, because throughout the book, he casts doubt on the efficacy of our senses and thinking and reason and such. Let me try out one more theory from him, because he has a whole rule devoted to the thing that he calls it is put your house in perfect order before you criticize the world. And he talks about the mentality behind the scumbags, like this guy. Although this scumbag did not follow Peterson's pattern, because Peterson said, hey, if these nihilist scumbags are consistent, they kill themselves too, to show
that
they,
you know, didn't. Usually they do.
Yeah. They're at war with being as such. But in this chapter, he talks about the fact that he believes it's understandable that people could reach the stage, given that life is suffering so much, that they would reach the stage that they feel that they're at war with being as such, that they are contemptuous of being, that they're contemptuous of human beings. He said in an earlier chapter in the book that if you are honest and you look into yourself, that you'll see that at some point in your life, you have wished to wipe all human beings off the planet, that anybody has wished this. Yeah. So, and for me, I'm puzzled. I'm thinking, I've never wished this. You know, as many bad things as may have happened to me in my life, the most I'm going to do is blame particular people. I could get caught up in like victim mentality. That would be an error I could make, but I'm not going to feel like I'm going to wipe everybody off the planet. So, you know, how does this happen? And in the chapter, this chapter six, he talks about if you reach this stage where suffering is so bad that you feel like you're at war with being as such, is the way he puts it. You've said existence, and that could be the way we talk about it. You know, that you feel like you don't think any human being deserves to live on the planet, including you. If you're at this stage, he says you could blame three different things. You could choose to blame three different things. One is God. One is fate, you know, some sort of
predestination
out there.
Yeah.
And then the third is you could choose to blame yourself. And then the total of the argument he gives you is, well, it could be God or it could be fate. But look, other people have chosen to blame themselves instead. And why don't you try blaming yourself and improving yourself and see what happens? And that's the essence of that chapter. So, you know, it's not a good argument, right? Because it makes the choice arbitrary. And in fact, he stacks the deck on the other side because he puts Tolstoy, you know, and he has a couple of glowing comments for Tolstoy as, you know, this creative genius. He says Tolstoy reached the stage where he was blaming, you know, these things. And if you blame God or if you blame fate, the natural consequences, you're going to go the violent route. So, you know, why choose the other?
But this is interesting because I think that it's the possibility of blaming God and blaming fate is part of what leads to this condition, right?
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
It's the feeling that life is outside of your control, that God is dictating. And it's true. If God exists, then why do bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people? How does that happen? How does that work? If God exists, why is he such a mean bastard, right? And he is, right? I mean, I can't think of if God really exists, he is a sadistic bastard. So, but that can't be because he's like all knowing. And so sadism must be part of reality, right? It must be a real force in reality for God to be such a sadist. So,
now the way he says it though, right, is that it, and you know, that's kind of Old Testament God would be the punishing one. And I haven't read the Bible, so I'm, you know, channeling it through Jordan Peterson, right?
You have. Yeah.
So Old Testament God versus New Testament God. New Testament God is a much more benevolent God, and people have a hard time believing him. You're believing in this benevolent God, given the world of suffering that we live in. So what he asks you to consider, and again, you're doing a leap of faith here, is if you started acting better and trying to make yourself better and then make the world a better place, then maybe being would improve to the extent that you'd start to believe that New Testament God and Old Testament God are one and the same. And so why not just try this? But exactly what you were getting to, it was my thought, which is that Peterson sees within himself that it seems reasonable to be at war with being. He puts these posters on his wall because he reveals in the book that he's had himself violent impulses that he's never acted upon, that before he went into his clinical practice, he said that almost everything he said was a lie. So he realizes this is bad and evil. He knows that the consequences are tyranny, nihilism. He has these posters on the wall. He's warning himself. Does he need to do this because he does believe in God or fate or a prime mover or however you put it, so that he can see himself being at war with reality? Because I've never had that feeling since age 12 when I first thought about the issue. I'm an atheist. I don't believe that there is this.
I became an atheist at age 6, so it's hard for me to put myself in a psychology of what it means to believe. But if I project that, then clearly it creates these real existential challenges. You know, why are these horrible things? So you see, what we believe is that ideas shape reality and shape the world, shape human behavior. And when we look at communism and Nazism, we don't see some malevolent force in the world causing death and destruction. What we see,
or letting it happen. Right?
What we see is the inevitable consequences of really bad ideas manifest themselves in the modern world. So the same ideas will manifest pretty much every century of human existence, but they didn't have the technology to be able to kill as many people as they did in the 20th century. But what we see is the inevitable consequences of ideas, and we know that people can change their minds. We know that people can shape their own ideas. So we're advocates of free will. We're advocates that our lives are in our own hands. We do shape our own destiny. There's no such some malevolent force out there causing people to behave in this way or letting this stuff happen, that it's in our hands and it's in human hands. So we despise Hitler and Stalin more, I think, than the religious person does, because we understand more fully that it was Hitler's and Stalin's choices that made what they did possible, and it wasn't some outside force on them. We despise, therefore, Immanuel Kant and Karl Marx and Hegel and Nietzsche, because we understand that it's ultimately their ideas that made the Hitler and the Stalin possible, and even to some extent Plato, right? We place moral blame on the initiators of ideas.
Although without Plato, there wouldn't be Aristotle.
I know, so Plato gets a pass. But, well, also, he was so early in philosophy that you have to give him the credit for asking the right questions, even if he gave the wrong answers. But nobody afterwards has any excuses. After Aristotle, they have no excuses. So we understand all that. So we both hate the perpetrators of evil more, and we understand, we have a benevolent view of the world in the sense that we understand how if people choose good ideas, these things don't have to happen and won't happen. Too much of what Jordan Peterson and most of these, I'd say modern intellectuals, the better modern intellectuals, are too deterministic. Even those who acknowledge there is such a thing as free will, they ultimately believe that history and individuals are shaped by external forces predominantly. So they bought into Marxist or Hegelian dialectic in some sense, or they bought into evolutionary psychology where they're these forces internal to us that are driving us in a particular direction, or they've just bought into God, and then you get all the problems with that. So yeah, I mean, I think this is, if we're none of the above, we're none of the above, right? And we're unique in that sense. Not only are we atheists, but we believe in free will, and we believe in the role of ideas in human history, and nobody else believes in the role of idea of human history. Almost nobody else does. Not in the same sense and not with the same kind of punch that we do, with the same seriousness that we do. It's not just ideas, it's philosophy, and we have a whole theory about how philosophy gets into the culture and how it shapes the culture. And, Leonard's written both Ominous Parallels and The Dim Hypothesis to articulate an entire philosophical theory of history, which these people don't have. So to them, particularly somebody intelligent like Jordan Peterson or even a Sam Harris or a lot of these people, history to some extent is kind of a mystery. They don't really understand.
And he'll say there's certain things that we just don't understand, for example, about our consciousness and things like that. But
sure,
that book really is a tour de force. But he just he makes certain errors that I think cripple him from fighting the very things that he wants to fight and that he's trying so valiantly, I think, to fight.
Absolutely.
I really admire him at the same time. Like
he's one of the smartest people and probably the most interesting person that I listen to online. I mean, he's fascinating. A lot of what he says is true, even though sometimes what he says it for the wrong reasons. And there's a lot to be learned because he brings a psychological dimension. I don't think in terms of psychology. Ayn Rand did. So if you read Ayn Rand's essays, I mean, there's so much psychology in every one of her essays in the 60s and 70s. It's stunning. I don't think in those terms. And Jordan Peterson only thinks in terms of psychology. He's not a philosopher. So to me, it's refreshing and interesting to be challenged from that perspective. And I think it makes us all better to be challenged by Jordan Peterson. Let me say something about guns, because there's this whole debate going on.
Okay.
Let me say first that I own a gun. I have a concealed weapons permit in California, which is not easy to get, and I own one. I have used guns. I was in the Israeli military. But more than that, when I was a teenager, there were terrorist attacks in Israel. And we would go hiking. Like I was a leader of a scout group, boys and girls. It was mixed in Israel. And we would go hiking, and I would carry a gun with me, a rifle, because of the threat of terrorism. So I know guns, right? I mean, you can accuse me of a lot of things, but I know I've shot big guns, I've shot little guns, I've carried weapons, I've been in situations where, potentially, you know, life-threatening. So don't give me the, you know, we might disagree about guns, but it's not a consequence of ignorance about guns. So, all right. What else?
Okay.
What do we want?
Are you ready
about?
To go on to Russia?
Sure. Do you know we have 200 people watching live?
Beautiful. Hi, yeah, people.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
Hello, hello. Yay.
All right.
That's awesome.
So
Russia. Let's talk about Russia. So the story that I saw was that they are actually indicting Russians now, which means
yeah,
what? They have some level of evidence that Russians are trying to interfere with our election. Yes?
Yeah. No question. I mean,
you know, everybody talks about I've just been sitting back and watching whatever is coming in, and there's one thing that of all the different stories that have come forth so far that was concerning to me. And it was Trump Jr., you know, Trump's son, sending that email about that meeting they were going to have with the Russian where they anticipated they were going to get some dirt on Hillary from Russians. They're told it's coming high in like, someplace in Russian government. And he says, if that's what it is, I love it. You know, he's all eager, right? This bothers me. And so here's my question for you, because I've never asked you this question. I've seen you a number of times, socially, whatever, and I haven't asked you this question. Is it troublesome to you that somebody in our government with a lot of influence, this is Trump's son in this case, is eager to accept help from Russians? I guess it's a two-part question. Do you see Russia as an enemy? And then is it a problem for a political candidate in the United States to accept help to win an election from an enemy?
I mean, it's the challenge is how to evaluate Russia. Let's start with the evaluation of Russia, because I think that's hard. And it's hard because of how weak we are, how pathetic we are. I mean, in a number of examples, this indictment is one of them. But there are a number of examples of this, of our own weakness. To the extent that Russia, as a policy of the Russian government, and I believe this is true, has set itself out to try to create instability in the United States by using propaganda against us, then yeah, I would call that an enemy, or at least a threat.
Well, what about fighting, hitting on us in Syria, striking
well,
us in
Syria. Syria? We'll get to Syria
okay.
in a minute. You know.
But I'm saying that there's a lot of things that Russia has done that we could classify
yeah,
them
but
as an enemy.
But I don't really believe Russia's an enemy, right? In this sense, in a sense that, I mean, they're our enemy because we're pathetic. If we
everyone's our
them,
enemy, though, because we're pathetic, right? You're our enemy. That's true of the jihadists as well.
If we stood up to them just a little bit, they would fold and they would become our best friends.
Well, they wouldn't be our best friends, but they would just have no power. Because they are who they are still, right?
Yeah, they're corrupt.
We would render them powerless.
Putin is evil. They would have no power. No, but it would also suck up to us. They'd like to be our friends. See, all Putin
but
is
they
doing,
still wouldn't be our friends. They'd just be sucking up.
Yeah, they'd be sucking up. All right. They wouldn't be true friends. They'd be pretend friends. But then in foreign policy, most of the friends are pretend friends. They're prodding us. And they want to see how far they can get. And Putin wants to be all-powerful. Putin wants Russia to become the most powerful entity in the world. He knows he can't match up to the United States in military strength or in influence right now. So what he'd like to do is weaken us internally and get us fighting among each other so that we get into decline, so that the ultimate power is him versus the Chinese. And I don't think he even thinks he can match up to the Chinese, because then the Chinese would kick his butt. But he's going after us because the Chinese wouldn't tolerate what we're tolerating, right? So he's prodding us. Now,
well, in terms of influence, though, there is this thing that we are doing in terms of leaving a vacuum in areas. So maybe he does think he can match us in influence.
Yeah, but I mean, also think that we have to talk about the vacuum and what it means and how you do foreign policy. So it's a big topic. But so let's imagine that some group of Russians decided to spread propaganda in the United States and just spread false news, and because they wanted, I don't know, Donald Trump to win or whoever, it doesn't really matter.
Well, no, but and to gain influence with our politicians, right? Because there's quite a bit of evidence that the Russians were trying to gain influence with Hillary Clinton. Yep. Of course, everybody thought Hillary Clinton was going to win. So I would expect that there would be a ton of evidence of them trying to have connections and have influence with her. She also had political power already, her husband, everything else. She was the favored one. So there'd be a lot more there. But then it would be natural once the tide started turning and it looked at least possible that Trump would win, that they would start pursuing those channels.
Well, I will say something that'll get rid of the rest of the people listening. I mean, clearly they wanted Trump to win. I mean, Trump was ideal for them. Trump is weak.
Divisive, yeah.
Trump is weak. He's divisive. He has no foreign policy. His America First is rhetoric that is completely empty of all content. Hillary Clinton had staked out a foreign policy which was antagonistic to Russia. She had said she would have a no-fly zone in Syria. She would go after them about Ukraine. Trump was potentially a Russian ally and could be manipulated. I really think they thought he could be manipulated. And I think he has been manipulated. I think Trump is being manipulated by the Russians beautifully all over the world. The Russians are one step ahead of this administration everywhere where we go. I mean, not militarily, but politically. Look what they've done in the Middle East. I mean, they've basically taken over the Middle East. So, you know, Trump, they wanted Trump. There's no question in my mind. But look, they were playing, I'm sure they were playing both sides. They had contacts into Hillary. They had contacts into Trump. But let's say it wasn't the government. Let's say it was just people writing propaganda and sending it to Facebook. Then you would have to say, who cares, right? You know, it's up to the American people to figure out what's false news and what's not false news, and not to pay attention to junk and not to pay attention to propaganda. People have a right to propagandize. Even Russians have a right to propagandize in America. The entity that doesn't have a right to propagandize in America is the Russian government. The Russian government, by propagandizing, taking a stand, choosing who they think should become president, actively acting to promote actor one versus actor two, all in the name of instability and weakening America. That is, you know, pretty close to an act of war. That is clearly wrong. And that needs to be stopped. And the fact that an American close to the nominee for the Republican Party would say, oh, yeah, let's work with the Russians, who are clearly doing all this. Now, the indictment does say that the people in the Trump campaign did not know that the Russians were doing what they were doing. So
you mean about this particular with the going to social media? And,
yeah, and that they
during,
were trying
right.
to manipulate
no,
the
that, that's
and
a different
like
issue.
That.
That's a different yeah. issue so, in terms of what the Trump campaign knew.
So I mean, the idea that you would go now, would Hillary have gone? I think so, maybe. Or maybe she's smarter than, maybe she's just more politically savvy. I think one of the things that you learn when you read about the Trump campaign is that it's a combination of amateurs. I mean, his kids have no knowledge of politics. I mean, you can understand that. They're just amateurs, and he's an amateur.
Sure.
And manipulative, scheming, Clinton-like operatives. And here I'm talking about Paul Manafort. I don't know if you've read about Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort is a piece of work. I mean, he is a crony, one of the people who have turned Washington, D.C. into one of the most crony places, and he's very much like a Clinton. He's very much in the line of kind of a Clinton manipulating and scheming and working both sides and everything. So the Trump campaign had all of that. So we've got two political parties today that are almost indistinguishable in terms of how corrupt they are and in terms of what they would do for power and so on. But look, yeah, I mean, the Russians are winning, and the Russians are the enemy, and we are doing nothing to stop them other than killing some mercenaries in Syria.
Well, and in the article that I had put the link in the program notes, it talks about Mattis playing down and sort of giving the Russians plausible deniability with respect to the role in Syria, and that this is a noble lie, and that it's okay to tell noble lies in order, I guess, to achieve certain foreign policy objectives. So if the idea is we don't want to have an escalation with Russia right now, is it okay in your view for Mattis to just give them this plausible deniability and say, oh, maybe they really didn't know what the mercenaries were doing.
I don't know if the people know about this, but there's an incident in Syria where a U.S. base or U.S. allied base in Syria, technically the U.S. has no bases in Syria, was attacked by a large group of Russian mercenaries together with Hezbollah and Iranian forces and Syrian forces to try to overtake this pro-U.S. Military base. And in retaliation, and during this attack, the U.S. military basically wiped out like at least 200 of these Russian mercenaries, supposedly. And so people are talking about that, and then what's his name, Mattis, then says, well, we don't know if they were really Russian, or we don't know if they were sent by the Russian government. And of course, they know all this stuff. Of course, they were sent by the Russian government. None of this stuff happens.
Perplexed or something.
Yeah, he was
right?
Perplexed. I mean, Crimea was Russian mercenaries. Eastern Ukraine was Russian mercenaries. No, these are all people guided by the Kremlin. These are all forces. And by the
apparently
way,
they were flown back and got hospitalized in Moscow or something. Mercenaries that we had no connection to.
That the leader of the mercenaries, a guy named Dmitry Utkin, who's a former lieutenant colonel in Russia's military intelligence, also has close ties to an oligarch by the name of Yevgeny something or other, doesn't matter, known as Putin's chef, because he owns the Kremlin's food service providers, right? So this Yevgeny, not only he's involved with these mercenary troops in Syria, but what's fascinating is he's also the guy who owns the hacking place where all the people were indicted for trying to manipulate the U.S. elections. So it's the same people in Russia, all with Kremlin links, all linked through this Putin chef, that are both involved in Syria and involved in the propaganda and involved everywhere. And if you believe in conspiracy theories, which I don't, this is a real one. The Russians are out there in the world, and it's the same characters within the Russian administration trying to manipulate what is going on in the world in order to create, to weaken the United States and to promote Russian interests, and they're willing to kill anybody, and they're willing to do anything in order to achieve those goals. So these are really, really bad guys. Putin is one of the real bad guys of in world politics today. Anyway, is it right for them to lie? I mean, there are circumstances in which it's okay to lie, but in this case, it's just a sign of weakness. Why not say, Russians, get the hell out of here. We don't need you. We won't want you. You know, you're attacking American troops. How dare you? Why are we afraid to escalate them? We just killed 200 Russians with not a single American casualty, I take it. What are we afraid of exactly? We could wipe these bastards out in Syria if we really wanted to. Now, there's a whole question of what are we doing in Syria and why are we there? But that's part of the problem. And the article actually talks about that, is that, you know, what are they supposed to do? You know, there's no policy about what Americans are there for. They're nominally there to destroy ISIS. But ISIS is pretty much destroyed. So what are they in Syria for? Who are they supporting? Are the Turks our friends or our enemies? And if they're our friends, why are we letting them attack the Kurds, who are our friends? Why are we letting two friends fight? I mean, it's just a complete and utter mess and a disaster in Syria. And to a large extent, because the United States doesn't have a foreign policy. And one foreign policy stand would be, we're not intervening. You guys, you know, have at it. Kill each other, slaughter each other.
Leave us alone.
Yeah, just leave us alone. Right. Go at it. You know, it's unfortunate where children and women are dying, but it's your problem, not ours, and we're not intervening and we're not coming in. That would be one option. But to kind of be in and kind of be out and kind of say this and kind of say that and lie about this and pretend that it's not, that's the worst kind of foreign policy. This is exactly, I never liked Mattis. I don't like anybody in who's commanding the military, the American military. Haven't liked anybody in positions of command in the military for the last 20 years or 30 years that I've been following.
There's a reason for that.
Yeah, they have
just
bad,
war theory.
Yeah, it's just war theory, which shapes everything that they do. But it's also, and this is exactly the cowardice of the United States not to say, Russia, you attack us one more time and we'll blow you out of, I mean, if we're there, and if we're not in Syria, then we shouldn't be in Syria. But if we're there, then act like we're there and don't act like, you know. So the whole thing is misconstrued and a complete disaster.
So Russia, enemy or no, and does it bother you that Trump's son was eager to accept help from them?
Oh, absolutely bothers me that Trump's son. I mean, but again, I think that Trump's son was so eager because he's an amateur. I think they're all amateurs. They didn't really know what they were doing. They were just fishing.
Well, all you're saying is that if they – so you think someone who's more professional would not be actually eager, or that they would just hide their eagerness better?
Well, they would certainly hide their eagerness better. I mean, this meeting happened in the Trump Tower.
Yes.
Which was monitored nonstop by journalists and everybody else. So, right. I mean, a little smart, you know, go in a car somewhere and meet at an undisclosed location. I mean, give me a break. If you're gonna get dirt from a foreign agent, you don't do it in broad daylight. But the amateurs also for asking for that kind of help, because you got to know that if the Russians give you that information, they're going to want something in return. And the question is, what do they want in return, and what kind of influence are they going to want? And that's the trade that is treasonous, potentially.
Yeah.
That's where
yeah.
you could get into treason, right? Are you undermining the security of the United States by accepting mm-hmm. favors? I mean, it's the same thing of that as that, you know, is that that horrible memo that came out about Trump having prostitutes and doing all this stuff in mm-hmm. Russia, and them having tapes of him and so on. The reason that's important is not because Trump uses prostitutes. We basically know that. I mean, all these women who say he's had an affair with them, all of them said that he tried to pay them, you know, at the end of the night. And they were all offended by the fact that he gave them that he tried to give them cash. Now, everybody's going to write, oh, you're wrong, you shouldn't believe. I mean, this is so real. I mean, I believe every word.
Well, that'll lead into another question. Finish your thought, though.
I believe every word of it. But so it's not the fact that he uses prostitutes. Who cares? It's the fact that that can be used against him to blackmail him. And again, that is a threat to the security if he's blackmailable. Now, I don't think Trump is blackmailable, because obviously his wife knows about all this stuff and doesn't care. And if she didn't know about this stuff, she knows now. And she's still with him, and you know, because power is it's like Hillary and Bill, right? Mm-hmm. Power unites these couples. The desire for power, the desire to be on TV and everything, much more than truth or love or decency or self respect. I mean, mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton has no self respect. Anybody who stays with a philandering, lying, cheating person mm-hmm. like Bill Clinton or like Donald Trump, it appears, deserves no respect from their spouse. But you know, they get it.
right. So that leads to a question, because you were talking about people telling you, Yaron, you shouldn't believe this stuff that you read in the media. And recently I saw a post on Facebook and it was, I think, specifically about the left-wing media's coverage of the Olympics and how, you know, they've basically,
it was that North Korean issue. It was about and I did a show on that. And I mean, it was horrible how the left media covered the North Korean princess.
So then the question is, cause I know, you know, you've listened to NPR and
I always do.
Obviously, you know, we're reading media sources that have a lot of left wing bias to them. How do you sift through and say, okay, what's reliable and what do I say? Yeah, I'll go ahead and believe that. I'm not going to, you know, for me, establishment media, the thing that it has going in its favor is resources. So if I said, oh, I'm never going to read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post or whatever.
Where are you going to get your news from?
Right. And who has the resources
exactly.
to actually go out there and get a comprehensive.
So I'm curious what the alternative news media is where you can actually get news, because it's not Breitbart. And it's not Drudge. Drudge is just an aggregator. Breitbart is mostly BS, and their headlines are just as biased just from the other side as some of the mainstream media, and they don't have the resources to break stories, except stories, and once in a while they do break a story, that are aligned with them ideologically. So they're big on, like, Muslim violence. They're very good at going and tracking that down, which to me – so you need to read that as well, you know, in order to get that part of the puzzle. But the fact is that it's the mainstream media, and I will include Fox in this, that has that does actual news reporting. Everybody else basically does opinion pieces. There's no other news reporting going on out there. It's either news that's made up, like Alex Jones. I forget what he calls his channel, the Alex Jones.
InfoWars,
which is just made up stuff. Or it's Breitbart, which has a few very small areas where they can produce news, but the rest is just commentary, basically. Ben Shapiro is just commentary. It's highlighting things from the mainstream media. They're not producing news.
Useful commentary, I find it.
A lot of times it's useful. Sometimes it's like Breitbart, but it's a mixture. It depends on the type of story.
I think it's a whole different class than Breitbart. It's much better than Breitbart.
Don't forget that Ben Shapiro worked for Breitbart. I don't think it's a whole different class. He's better, but I don't think it's a different class. I think it's when the issues, certain issues, it seems about the same in my view. So I completely agree with everybody who says you can't trust the mainstream media. Absolutely, you can't trust them. You have to have a discerning mind. You have to sift through it. But to say, I'm never going to read the New York Times. I'm never going to read Reuters. I'm never going to listen to NPR. I'm never going to watch CNN. I'm never going to use any of these mainstream. Then how are you going to get any news? Where are you going to actually find out what's going on in the world? You're just going to use a filter. And the filter is biased because all the filters out there are biased. So what you need to do is you need to develop your own mental skills, your own cognitive abilities in being able to tell, okay, what makes sense and what doesn't. Like the North Korea one was so easy, right? And it was so easy. Yeah, these people are nuts to call her this. And indeed, there was a huge backlash on Twitter and everything else, everywhere else, against the mainstream media. I mean, that's easy. It's the most subtle ones that are difficult. It's figuring out, if a news story is true, then figuring out if the quotes are true. So I'll give you an example. This is about guns. Somebody posted this link saying, gun violence in Europe in these mass shootings is just as high as the United States. And they linked to a story. And the story, the URL is from a criminal research foundation. So it sounds legit. And then they have these tables. And they have these tables with the number of deaths per capita from shootings where more than four people die. So mass shootings, right? And then they show that the United States is like 12th. And like Switzerland is like number 7 in the number of people per capita, per million people, who die from mass shootings. And then they do another table with the incidents. And you go, wow, this is good. And these are numbers, right? These are real numbers. So it must be right. The United States is not as violent as I always thought it was. Okay. Then you click on it and it gives you the actual data. And then if you know anything about statistics, you suddenly realize that these people are either they're really ignorant or they're manipulative liars, right? They chose a period of time, 2009 to 2015, 6 years, where there was one incident in Switzerland. Many, many incidents in the United States, one in Switzerland. But because Switzerland has such a small population, one incident over 6 years in Switzerland gives you a higher per capita murder rate in these mass shootings than it does many incidents in the United States. Now, that's bizarre. I mean, that means you cannot statistically extrapolate that from that one incident, that if you grow Switzerland however many times you have to grow it to make the U.S. population, you would get that multiple of incidents. So it's to figure out the truth, even when people give you numbers, is hard. What I also do now is when they quote, where they give you a quote, I go look for the origins. I try to find the source of the quote because I'll often quote them out of context. Right. So my point is this, you have to research. You actually have to go and look. Now, unless it's a story that I know something about, so that gives me confidence that it's true. Or unless I've done the research into it, I am not going to post stuff. I am not going to declare this is real, it's true. I am not going to assume anything until I've done the research. And it's sad that we have to live in a world where you have to do this, because that's the job of journalists, to do the research and to let us know what's true and what's not, and to quote people. But I don't trust them. And so I sympathize with those. But that doesn't mean I can't use them as a source. I have to use them as a source because it's the only source that exists. So you have to use them as a source. You have to read across many different sources. You have to dig into the story. You have to do a little bit of research. And even then, you have to accept that you might be wrong.
That you weren't there watching the events happen as they unfolded, and that we are unfortunately in a world where some people in the news media might not even be honestly just reporting the events, which is a pretty scary place for
us to be. And how many people, even when they're trying, can actually be objective about the world? I mean, there's so many cases in which
something happens
and you ask five people what just happened and there are five different interpretations of it.
Okay, but now you're going down the same path that Jordan Peterson goes in his book, right? Where it's the skepticism about our ability to be objective.
But I think I'm skeptical about some people's ability to be objective. I'm not skeptical about it. I'll put it this way. I'm not skeptical about our ability to be objective. I'm skeptical about whether people are
exercising
actually,
it.
Exactly, exercise it. Because I think it needs to be taught, right? Cognition needs to be taught. I don't think it's automatic. So we're not automatically objective, particularly in abstract, and particularly when emotions are high, it's very hard to be objective, and you have to exercise it. And this is Ayn Rand's unique perspective on free will, right, and on cognition, that it has to be turned on. And this is what Jordan Peterson and none of these people understand about free will. The essential of free will is that you know, willingness, that engagement of turning it on and being alert and being aware and committing yourself to being objective. Most people are not. So I agree with Jordan Peterson that most people are not objective, because most people don't even know what that is and have not turned it on, not consistently. They might be objective at work and not at home, or when they're calm but not when they're emotionally engaged. So being objective is work. Thinking is work. Any kind of conceptual engagement is work. And it's work that needs to be taught and practiced. And in a world in which our educational system is so lousy, you can't trust people to do that.
Right. And that's where I find Peterson's advice valuable. So he talks about, you know, be the lobster and everything. He's giving you information about certain mechanisms within you that make it more of a challenge for you to be objective at certain times or in certain situations. And the answer is not, oh, well, let's throw out reason and objectivity altogether, but it's saying, okay, I realize that if I'm in this kind of certain situation, I'm going to have to really be focused to be objective. Or if I have a big life decision, I'm not going to make that big life decision when I'm in this stressful period of my life, or, you know, whatever it is, to be aware of things about us that do exist. Yeah, there are things that do exist that are the serotonin mechanism we share with lobsters or whatever, but it doesn't make objectivity impossible. It's just something that we need to be aware of and then get ourselves to focus and put ourselves in the best situation so that we can focus.
I mean, all of us know that when we're emotionally riled up, it's hard to think. That's just a fact. Whatever the chemicals are that are associated with emotion make it difficult to think clearly. And this is true whether one is angry or whether one is sexually aroused or, you know, there are a lot of things that just cloud judgment. And that's why people always, I couldn't help it, right? But that doesn't actually free you from the requirements of your survival, which is to focus and to put aside the emotional thing that's going on and to use your mind and to make judgments and to make decisions that are rational, because you know what happens when you don't. It is anti your life. It is anti human survival, and therefore it is evil. So you've got to use your mind. And so this is my whole thing about evolutionary psychology. It is true that when we don't engage in our cognition, we act at the perceptual level, which Ayn Rand talks about a lot. And I equate the perceptual level with, and this is my theory, so this is not objectivism, but I equate the perceptual level with all these things that they talk about in evolutionary psychology. So if we were animals and didn't have the ability to override all this, this is how we would behave if we were just perceptual beings. So, you know, we would, in economics, it's simple, right? If you're just perceptual, every trade looks like a zero-sum game. You have to engage a conceptual element to say, no, wait a minute. This person's gaining and this person's gaining and this is why they transact and this is how they gain and this is how you can measure the gain and so on. But that requires cognition. That requires effort. That requires thinking. But if we stay at the perceptual level, yeah, we're guided by who knows what. By to some extent, some stuff in our genes, our emotions, and what our mother told us, all kinds of BS stuff. That's what being conscious.
Not necessarily BS stuff, though, Yaron, right? It's not BS. I mean, these are things that are part of us as human beings. You know, we can't, you know, bewail the fact that all these different things are part of who we are. But what we do is we say, okay, we're going to be aware of those things. We're not going to act on those things when those things don't go along with our conscious judgment of what is best for us.
True.
Right?
But some of them are bad for us, and some of them we need to. What do you call it? Exercise. How about that for a religious term, right? We need to exercise them. So, you know, if your mother taught you things that are causing you, bad emotions or bad, then get rid of it. You know, figure out.
Right, right.
This is what psychology
what I'm referring
should
to
be
there
about.
Is,
helping you.
I'm referring to the mechanism within us that makes us susceptible to absorb those things. It's just all part of what we are as human beings. So, yeah, we can say, okay, given my particular situation, there were certain bad things that I absorbed from my childhood. But everybody absorbs things from their childhood. It's part of what we need to do as human beings to grow up and mature as kids.
And as we grow up, we filter out the stuff that's useful and the stuff that's not useful. We
hopefully, if we're active.
Yes, and if we're active and if we're healthy psychologically. And part of what a rational psychology would be about is exercising the demons, is getting rid of the garbage that's in there, that doesn't belong there, that doesn't, bad conclusions we've come to, things that we've been told that are just untrue. All of that stuff would be exercised, would be eliminated if we had a good psychological theory, good psychologists.
Right. Yeah. And as it stands, though, we have to take the ones that are the best out there, but who don't share our philosophical premises and see if we can.
Absolutely. Not against going. I'm not against psychology.
Yeah. Actually, it sounds like from this discussion that you're more interested in it that you want to let on, actually.
Oh, no, I'm interested in it. I'm just skeptical.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's healthy to be skeptical about the conclusions, at least, of a newer science. And yeah, now you're cautioning people, look at studies as well. And look at numbers. One thing I was going to say about those numbers that you mentioned with respect to guns, I just posted a link to this excellent video by Bill Whittle, and he has a number of statistics that he cites, not necessarily about mass shootings, but about gun violence as such. And it puts, I believe, United States at 111 out of 200 and some odd countries for which they've measured the gun violence. I don't remember the span of years, but the video was posted a couple of years
ago.
You
have to be very careful about these things. You have to find out what the data really is. Who are we being compared to? I'm sure gun violence in northern Nigeria is higher than it is in the United States. One of the things that they were doing with mass shootings, for example, was including terrorist attacks in it. So we're including the Charlie Hebdo in Paris and so on. You could include that. You could exclude that. You have to know what you're actually measuring, and you have to know what the statistics is actually telling you. And is it a valid statistic? For example, what is the statistical significance of the difference between the two? Is there statistical significance? I mean, statistics is – I've taken lots of classes in statistics, and I'm not that good at it. I know enough to know how dangerous it is and how it can be misused. There's a wonderful little book about how to misuse statistics, about how to use statistics badly to prove anything you want to prove. So all I'm saying is be very wary. And just because the data that comes out supports your position doesn't make it true, right? So I am wary of all of those. Also, when it comes to economic issues, you know, when they issue statistics, I'm very wary, even when it's supportive of my position. You have to really, okay, what's really going on? You know, is this true? Isn't it true? it's not easy. And it's not easy to live in the world we live in today and figure out what in the news is true and what is not. Let me just say, a lot of you, so some of you are writing questions on the chat. We are not answering questions on this show. We're purposefully doing that. It's too distracting. And too many of your questions are unrelated to what we're talking about. But I am going to do, and you know, Amy can decide what she wants to do, but I'm going to do a Q&A tomorrow. So my Living Objectivism show tomorrow is going to be all Q&A. You can tune in here on Facebook and on YouTube and on Blog Talk, and I'll just take your questions off of the chat, and you can call in. So we're not taking calls. I know somebody's called in and been standing online for a long time waiting for us to take the call. We're not taking calls. We're not answering your question on the chat, but you will have other opportunities to ask the same questions.
For me, actually, I'm trying to grow my little fledgling Patreon page.
That's right.
And I've got a few people in at the ground floor, and I'm going to be answering some questions Q&A from them in the next couple of days. But if people want to come on and become a patron at my Patreon page, I'm going to do regular Q&As there as well. Plus, of course, I have my own show on Wednesday on Herd, and there I take questions, callers, stuff like that.
Yep. So Patreon is a great way to support us as independent intellectuals. We appreciate the support. We're not going to pay by anybody to do these shows. I know some people think I'm still being paid by the Institute to do the show, but I am not. It really does depend on you guys. And Amy's not being paid by anybody to do all this. So if you value it, we'd really appreciate the support. Tomorrow I'll be doing a show starting at the same time. I think it's 3 p.m. Puerto Rico time, 2 p.m. Eastern time. And your show is when? When is Don't Let It Go, Amy?
So my show is on Wednesdays, and it's typically 3 p.m. Eastern time, noon Pacific time, for an hour and a half or so.
All right.
What I usually do.
Okay, what else? I know.
We have a couple things. One is this article from Wall Street Journal, sort of an opinion essay, What Can't Be Debated on Campus. And you sent this to me, Yaron.
Yeah.
And the thing that struck me about this is that now we are seeing professors, even at a law school, failing to model the proper, cognitive function when they are advocating for particular points of view or thinking about things. So just quoting, there's this poor woman, her name happens to be Amy as well. Her name's Amy Wax, and she's a professor at a school, and she took,
law school. This is not just any law school. This is one of the top law schools in the country. Not Wharton, University of Pennsylvania law school, right?
Right. Yeah. UPenn. So she's there.
Yeah.
And, she co-wrote with someone from San Diego a controversial opinion piece, and colleagues of hers disagreed with it. And there were two different open letters written. And apparently one of the open letters displayed arguments and reasoning talking about why she was wrong. But then there was another open letter that was written by some colleagues that had no argument to it whatsoever. And so she's talking about, what it is that professors in academia should do, what sort of intellectual functioning they should model for their students. And I'll just quote one paragraph from it. She says, "What those of us in academia should certainly not do is engage in unreasoned speech, hurling slurs and epithets, name-calling, vilification, and mindless labeling. Likewise, we should not reject the view of others without providing reasoned arguments. Yet these once common standards of practice have been violated repeatedly at my own and other academic institutions in recent years, and we increasingly see this trend in society as well." So, this is just one more step away from the ability to have reasoned discussion on campus. It's a huge step because now it's involving faculty members.
I think that's right. I was just thinking of a positive to come out of all of this, and that is, I think what the whole free speech issue on campuses is causing people to do is actually become explicit advocates for reason. Because suddenly they realize that reason is under attack. Now, I don't think they have the right definition of reason necessarily. Too many of them are Kantians. But at least coming to the forefront is this discussion about reason and the legitimacy and validity of reason. And now we can debate what reason is and how it functions and what it is and what it isn't. But this is related to Steven Pinker. It's related to this woman, Amy, who I disagree with on some of the things she wrote. So I wouldn't have agreed with her op-ed. But right. So the point of the piece was that she says that her colleagues basically wrote, this is half of the faculty of the law school at the University of Pennsylvania, basically, you know, were advocating to shut her up and that what she was doing was offensive and emotionally distressing. And one of her colleagues told her that he had a rotten summer vacation because of her op-ed, and it ruined his whole summer, and that, she should feel guilty for it. And he didn't make any arguments about this point is wrong and this point is wrong and this point I disagree with, and here's some counter facts. No, it was just this emotional spewing. And this is coming from the faculty. Now, I'm not surprised because the students would never initiate this nonsense. So it's always been, I think, from the faculty. Mm. That is this attitude is being taught to the kids, right? But now,
right, but I guess usually it's more hidden in the classroom, and then here it is coming out in this open letter. They're getting emboldened, in effect.
This is an op-ed you should all read. It's in the Wall Street Journal. It's excellent. I think it was on yesterday. It's a long piece. It's a long editorial. And
I've got the link at my blog at don'tletitgo.com, by the way. I put program notes there.
And, of course, I think the Wall Street Journal is one of the better newspapers out there. Again, it's kind of mainstream media, and you have to be careful, particularly when you read the news stories. But it has the best editorials in the country. And even the news tends to be better than most, but you have to use the same judgment. But, yeah, it's an excellent editorial, and she's really good on this. But what's nice is we're getting people on the right. She's clearly on the right. She's a conservative. And we're getting people on the left coming out defending reason and defending debate and defending facts and defending evidence. And if nothing else, what this attack on free speech is doing, Dave Rubin and Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson and Gad Saad and these guys, they're coming out and it's creating what I guess the Weinstein brothers are calling and Dave Rubin is calling this new, I guess, intellectual movement. Now, It's an intellectual dark web, all right?
Trying to become a card-carrying member. I'm really working hard here.
I don't think I'm a member of the dark web yet. But it is this – it crosses across from right to left. And, of course, objectivists were neither, none of the above. And
You're liking this title. It's occurring to you as we're talking. So I don't know, Yura.
That's right. And what unites them all is really this perspective on reason. And again, I think as objectivists, we've got a lot of educating to do to teach them what reason actually means and what free will is and what free will means and what is evolutionary psychology and how to look at it and all the other stuff. So there's a lot of garbage there. And, of course, those coming from the left have no understanding of economics, and those coming from the right have the baggage of religion. But what unites them is reason. And at the end of the day, I really do think that that you have to win the epistemological battle before you win any other battle. If we win on the Enlightenment, if we win on reason, then now we can engage in a discussion about egoism. And if we win on egoism, capitalism is easy. That's capitalism is over. That's a slam dunk. So the real battle is on reason and egoism. And it's nice that we don't yet have any allies on egoism.
No.
But we have allies on reason.
Shapiro says our egoism is garbage. And
yes,
I've challenged him to discuss it. I'm hoping
garbage.
He'll do it. But
yeah, how we treat each other, human relationships, objectivism is garbage. But yeah, so we have no allies in egoism, but the fact that we're starting to get allies in reason, at least superficially, is a good sign. And, I'm still just at the beginning of Steven Pinker's book.
Sure.
But I'm encouraged. Now, he categorizes Rousseau and Kant as Enlightenment thinkers. They're the destroyers of the Enlightenment. They're the anti-Enlightenment. So he doesn't quite get what the Enlightenment is, and he doesn't quite get what reason is. And he's got this funny concept called humanism. Which is an attempt to get at individualism, but he can't quite go there because he can't give up on altruism. The same problem the Founding Fathers had and the same problem the Enlightenment indeed had. These are all the things that Ayn Rand fixes about the Enlightenment and where we
they,
can
but
really
they want
help
to ignore her.
I know what they want to ignore Ayn Rand. That's the greatest tragedy of the 20th century is the smart intellectuals like Mises and Hayek and these new guys like Harris and Pinker are ignoring Ayn Rand. That will turn out from an historical projection 1,000 years into the future, looking back, that'll be the tragedy of the 20th and 21st century, bigger in a sense than Marx and anything like that. The fact that they ignored Ayn Rand is going to have horrific consequences in the future of the world.
And that's
I hope I'm
what
wrong.
I hope you're wrong too. That's the sense that I got also in reading Peterson's book. And I understood as I went on why he would ignore her. He actually said explicitly in his book at one point that if you have really new ideas, something that's so different, then chances are you're probably wrong because he has this bias in his mind toward whatever tradition has.
I mean, this Hayek was the same way. I mean, Friedrich Hayek was big on evolutionary of institutions, evolutionaries of beliefs, evolution of. So if something exists today, then it must have a reason to exist today. And if it had a reason to exist today, we should err on the side of believing that it's good. Because
right.
evolution, cultural evolution, what he called cultural evolution, has led to its existence today. And I mean, that's a horrible point of view, and it's very dangerous because, of course, socialism is strongly here. But, you know, it's part of what we have to struggle against. The better thinkers of the 20th and 21st century is they're still confused, and the enemy there, as always, is Kant. Kant, it is undercuts. Even the better people, the undercuts, you know. So I wonder when you dive deep, what does Pinker mean by reason? And it worries me. What does Pinker even mean by science?
Well, I'm gonna dive into that book next. But yeah.
Well,
for example, and I think
Much
I told you I shared there was an interview with him in Weekly
yep.
Standard,
yep.
and this one pull quote was just so powerful.
Excellent.
He says, you know, there is some plausibility to the idea that we can't necessarily know, like I can't know what it's like to be a man. You can't know what it's like to be a woman.
Right.
You know, you don't necessarily know what it's like to be a discriminated against black person.
Well,
okay,
but I can't know
says,
exactly what it's like to be you. I mean, that affects
right.
that even to another man. I mean, we're all different. We have our own individual consciousness. So,
right. But he says what the whole identity movement does is undermine this beautiful capacity that human beings do have, you know, and this is part of the Enlightenment, what we learned during the Enlightenment, that human beings have this ability to imagine and conceptualize what other people are going through. And instead, what do? We criticize people for so-called cultural appropriation when they engage in an attempt to actually see what it's like to be this other person or live this other life or have that other experience. So he's got, from what I can tell, some really good things. I like the fact that, you know, maybe he doesn't understand reason the way that we do, but he's tending to try to shore up what he does understand. I'm interested to look at the book and see what he's got to say.
No, I think he's very, I mean, I've seen some videos of him. I've seen him do the debates. And I loved his book, Better Angels of Our Nature, and I recommend that book to everybody, particularly the first half of it. I think the second half drags and becomes less interesting, but the first half is brilliant, just brilliant. And I think he's an incredibly smart guy, and he's on the right side on so many issues, on what I think at the end of the day, the important issues. But he's still wrong on other things. So, but in this case, pointing out the hypocrisy of the left is just of the kind of it's just too easy. You've got to go to the heart of it, and the heart of it is individualism, collectivism, it's egoism, altruism, and these are the things they don't want to name. They'll name tribalism a little bit, but they don't really want to go there. Now, Jordan Peterson, to his credit, will say that civilization is about individualism. It's about the separation from the group, separation from the tribe, and that the essential struggle in Western civilization is between individualism and collectivism. And that's great. And I wouldn't be surprised.
He does, but you know, as I said
know.
In his book, he undermines it.
But
because
he can't give up an altruism. And if you don't give up an altruism, then you have to be a collectivist at least a little bit. And you're drawn to it to some extent. And the group imposes this power on you because your moral responsibility is to it. It's not to you. So it's, unless they give up on altruism, forget about anything else. So, but first we got to get them on reason. And that's about, you know, that's even with Jordan Peterson, that's a challenge, right? So they get things in different places, and Pinker's going to get things.
They're quite good.
Yeah. Things than Jordan Peterson, who's going to get different things than, you know, I don't even consider Ben Shapiro on the same scale as these guys, like, because he's so politics oriented and so superficial in that way. But these other thinkers, you get them. I mean, they're so good on some things and they're so terrible on other things. It's like, come on, guys, read, you know, pick up Virtue of Selfishness, or pick up Capitalism Not an Ideal, or pick up Philosophy Who Needs It. I mean,
or have a conversation with us on our show.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure how much good that would be.
Okay, well, I've invited Peterson. I have an open invitation to Peterson. I will talk with him at any time. I'm hoping I've earned it after doing three shows on his book.
I mean, I would love to talk to Peterson, but I'm dubious about what good it would do. So maybe I underestimate. I mean, I think
I would learn something for sure.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, he'd gain respect for objectivism. Maybe not. It's hard to tell.
My whole goal, if I got to talk to Shapiro, would just be to have him say, okay, it's not garbage. I don't agree with it, but it's not garbage.
No, my goal with Shapiro is to convince him that he really is a socialist. That his altruism necessitates to be a socialist. You know, I want consistency.
Nice. Are you ready for one more?
Because he stays with her only because God demands it, not because he really loves her. Which is implied by his, you know, there's a hot.
I don't think he thinks that, though. His wife sounds like a kick butt person.
Of course he doesn't think that. But when he says, you know, the temptation of the hot chick at the bar instead of staying with your kid. I mean, give me a break. Is that really... So it's the sacrifice? Is that what's causing you to stay with the kid? Because your duty to the kid, your duty to sacrifice?
He's got his wife who's a doctor. I mean, what in the world? I don't know.
Anyway. All right. We have like 4 minutes.
Yeah. So, okay. The last story is the so-called tyranny of convenience.
Oh, my God.
This op-ed that I saw at New York Times. Yeah. And the guy says, you know, given the growth of convenience as an ideal, as a way of life, it's worth asking what our fixation is doing to us and our country. He says it's not necessarily a force for evil. Making things easier isn't wicked, but he says that it's not always good. And he says this convenience can become a constraint on what we're willing to do. And in a subtle way, convenience can enslave us. And then if you skip down in the piece, he gets concerned about the convenience, for example, of Facebook. We portray ourselves on Facebook, but he's saying that it encourages us basically to homogenize ourselves. We're not really going to be individuals. He says Facebook seems to make us all the same. Its format and conventions strip us of all but the most superficial expressions of individuality, such as which particular photo of a beach or mountain range we select as our background image. What are your thoughts on tyranny of convenience?
There's a sense in which there's some truth there, right? And that's the problem with all these things. There's always a sense in which it's true. To the extent that life is really easy, and I think for a lot of our kids and a lot of the generation coming up now, life is incredibly easy. And they are detached from reality. They don't engage with reality. They're not taught to think, and they're not taught to set goals. They're not taught to push themselves and to achieve. And yet, because of the welfare state and because of, I don't know, their parents being wealthy or because of all the wealth accumulated in society, they can basically live a convenient life without setting goals, without pushing themselves, without achieving, without really
And also not
anything.
Understanding what makes those conveniences possible.
Exactly. Without appreciating the hard work and the effort and the brilliance of the people who created all the conveniences for them. Mm-hmm. But the fact is people today can exist at a pretty good standard of living, historically, like kings and queens, right? Without exerting any effort or very little effort. Now, they live pathetic, miserable lives, but that's part of what the op-ed is saying. They do live pathetic, but that's not because of the conveniences. It's because of what we're teaching, because we're not teaching them to set goals, because they're not choosing to set goals, because they're not pushing themselves. All these conveniences are there. I mean, the beauty of the conveniences. What a life we live. I mean, how amazing is it? We don't have to toil.
We're here right now across country from each other putting this show out.
Yeah, and you didn't have to toil in the fields this morning. And I didn't have to go and lay bricks in the whatever, right? We didn't have to do any physical labor in order to
physical labor after I get off this show, actually. I got to clean my house, but yeah.
Well. I mean, minimal physical labor.
Right.
And
right.
We live good lives, right? We live good lives. You can actually, maybe not in California, but in some places around the country, you can live at a pretty high standard of living on a pretty low income. We have cars, we have the internet, which is basically for free. All of this we're doing is for free. We're, you know, just in the 80s, we had to pay AT&T these massive bills for long distance phone calls. You know,
right.
Most of the listeners don't even remember those days. But convenience is unbelievable. Now, what does that mean? That means that all the drudgery can be taken out. All the stuff we don't like can be taken out. And we can really focus our minds and our efforts on the things we love, on the things that are real challenges, and the things that grow us as human beings, on the things that allow us to really flourish as human beings. So it's not the convenience that you have to denigrate, which is what he's doing in this article, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. What you denigrate is the lack of ambition, the lack of focus, the lack of value setting, the lack of achievement, the lack of drive that so many young people exhibit today. And that is not the fault of technology. That is the fault of our educational system. That's the fault of our public educational system. It's the fault of you know, the whole structure of education in the world today, and bad parenting. So it's that is what is driving you know, this attitude among young people. So instead of blaming the real source, he's going on after superficial attribute of life, which is, yeah, life is unbelievably convenient. I was going to say thank God, but I should actually be thanking Rockefeller and Carnegie and Mellon and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and Larry Ellison and I don't know who else, but the thousands, the tens of thousands of geniuses who have made our lives convenient. That's an understatement, right? To say it's convenient.
Exactly. Right. So we got to sign off, right? So,
I think so.
Tell everybody.
I mean, we could go on for hours. But
our Patreon pages
healthy.
And help us out if you enjoy our show.
So we're going to be doing these, I think, every Saturday. The times are going to change because my travel schedule is nuts. So next Saturday we need to talk, Amy, because we'll have to do it earlier because I got on a flight to London. I am going to be in England. So those of you listening from the UK, I'm doing 12 high schools, talking to 12 high schools. But I am going to do a panel conversation with Saragun of Arcad. Live, so you should come and ask questions and challenge us. I'm also going to do a talk at the London School of Economics, so that is also open to the public. So please come to those. What else?
I look forward to hearing about the Safe Space Marshals.
That's right, the Safe Space Spacemen. The Safe Space Marshals are going to come to the King's College, if we do it at King's College. There's some debate about maybe moving the Saragun of Arcad out of King's College so we don't have to deal with the Marshals. I actually want the Marshals because I think it would be fun to point out the Marshals and to make
fun
of the Marshals.
You sounded like you were left out by the Marshals before, that you felt a little slighted.
I want to antagonize them, so the time I go to King's College, I have Marshals. I mean,
all by yourself.
Saragun gets Marshals and I get no Marshals. So, yeah, I need to raise my offensive profile. I don't offend enough people. I'm, and if people really understood, they would realize that I'm far, far more offensive than what's his name, Milo and
Milo Yiannopoulos.
Yeah, far more offensive than Milo. Milo just uses four-letter words, which I won't. But in terms of actual offense, philosophical offense, ideological offense, I'm much more upsetting. All right, guys.
We offended Shapiro. So hey.
What's that?
Shapiro.
I hope so. I hope a little bit. Enough to debate me. We'll see if he agrees to do that.
I hope he does.
I think Dave Rubin is working on it. All right. Let's see. So we're going to do this again on Saturday. And Amy's got her show on Wednesday. And you can follow her on Facebook. And
YouTube. Subscribe to me on YouTube.
Subscribe to her on YouTube. She's got a new channel on YouTube. And she's got a kick-ass Instagram account. I don't know if that's private or not.
No, it's not. Yeah.
I don't have any quick cap. Somebody on Facebook today did launch this whole thing about how I should have Instagram, and I said, look, guys,
I don't have time for
Instagram. I can't. I have social media core epistemology. I can't do more than the few that I do. So if anybody wants to volunteer to take over my Instagram account, call Blanche. You have full authority to do anything until I fire you. And you're willing to do it as a volunteer, I'm open to that. So just email me or drop me a note on one of the things. Anyway, those of you on YouTube right now, subscribe to my channel. Subscribe to the channel, subscribe to Amy's channel, all the other stuff, Patreon, whatever. And we will, hopefully you've enjoyed the show. If you have, there's one thing that's more important than anything else that you can do, and that is to share it. Share. It's the only thing you do on social media that the algorithms really, really care about. All the liking and smiles and thumbs and all this stuff, that's cute, but it's meaningless. The only thing that really adds value is to share. Mm-hmm. So please share YouTube, Facebook, everywhere, LinkedIn, Google+, that still exists, by the way, and everything else. Share, particularly out of YouTube. And we'll see you all next week. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, Yaron. This has been so much fun with none of the above.
Bye.
Bye.
Let's see how I shut this off. All right, there. End meeting. End meeting for all. Done. End episode.